Storytel Original presents Becoming Sherlock 1, The Red Circle, based on an original idea by Anthony Horowitz, written by Anthony Horowitz and Sarah J. Norton, narrated by me, Alfred Enoch. Chapter 1. The Man on the Path. As the darkness draws in, London seems to hold its breath, preparing itself for whatever wickedness the next 12 hours may bring. Westminster Bridge is empty, the Houses of Parliament black shadows against a steel-grey sky. The clock, known as Big Ben, is stuck permanently, appropriately, at 11 o'clock, the 11th hour. The moon struggles to show itself, and its reflection appears briefly in the oily water of the River Thames. But then it's gone, and only the gas lamps light the way, their frail glow hopelessly inadequate against the invading night. A single man walks along the embankment, his shoulders hunched and his hands deep in his pockets, heading for Pimlico, where he rents a room. He has a slight limp. He has an old injury which makes itself known whenever the weather is cold or damp. And tonight it is most certainly both. He could wait for the omnibus, but he's empty and exhausted after a 9-hour shift, and he has decided that it will be faster this way, as well as saving him money that he can spend on his evening meal and, more importantly, the drink that goes with it. His name is John, and he is a hospital porter, working in the lumbering construction of St. Thomas's Hospital, which is not at all saintly and, with the endless chaos, the queues in the corridors, the shortage of medical provisions, can barely be called a hospital. He is not as old as his gait might suggest. In his early 30s, he would be handsome, if he only smiled more and perhaps carried fewer of his troubles on his shoulders. He is clean-shaven, with the regular features and the intelligent eyes of a man you could immediately trust. He has a doctor's eyes. No moon now. The fog has come in dank and sulphurous, and John can't see more than a few feet beyond the light cast by the gas lamps. As he walks along the pavement, spectres materialise and dissolve, and the sound of his footsteps seems detached from his body, as if they belong to someone else. Someone following him or approaching him from the cover of the fog. Passing carriages are just patches of hazy darkness.
"Does the Bible not tell us? There will be earthquakes, famines, and pestilence. The end is coming. It will be with us very soon."
The familiar voice swims through the fog. Holy Peters is abroad, as he is every night. Gaunt, wild-eyed, and bedraggled, in appearance very much like the biblical prophet he believes himself to be. He likes to find a lamp close to a crossing and positions himself there, shaking his fist and passing out printed tracts to anyone who passes by. John has seen him inside the hospital too. It seems that Londoners don't like hearing about their imminent destruction, and Holy Peters is a regular visitor to the casualty department, with a blackened eye or bloody nose. The strange thing is that he never warns the doctors or the nurses of the end of the world. Perhaps he feels a little more optimistic when he's sitting indoors with a rug over his knees and a hot cup of tea. John quickens his pace, not wanting to be accosted, but he hears the prophet's voice as he approaches the short flight of stairs that will take him down to the Thames path.
"The Lord will send his vengeance. It will come out of the sky, a thunderbolt of flame that will fall on London and devour all those who have failed to repent."
Rubbish. The good Lord will not destroy London. It's been years since he even remembered it was there. John knows, how many times has Nurse Hudson told him, that he shouldn't go home along the embankment. The wall that separates the river walkway from the road above provides the perfect cover for thieves and cutthroats. But for him, the road is worse. People and vehicles lunge at him out of the darkness, and the occasional retort of a hoof against the asphalt is enough to make his heart pound. No. Down there, it is a more easeful journey, and his army-issue revolver is a reassuring weight in his pocket. He dares not leave it at his lodgings. He's certain the landlord goes through his belongings, but there's a sturdy padlock on the hospital locker where he can stash it while he's at work. He's glad he has it now. As he walks down to the Thames path, the silence rises to swallow him up, and his senses snap to alertness. He can't help it. Years on the battlefield have made him hypervigilant to the slightest sound or flash of movement. Not that he can see more than 5 paces ahead of him. The embankment wall is a strip of shadow to his right, and beyond it, keeping noiseless pace with him, is the river. He can hear the splash of greasy water against the brickwork, smell the effluent from factories and sewers that always finds its way here. The tide must be high again. Somewhere downriver, the lightermen are calling to one another, and there is the occasional mournful honking of a barge as it transports goods to the docks away to the east. It makes him think of exotic fruits and spices, a stark contrast to what he'll have for his supper. He can only afford a single room for his lodgings, so he can't lay in stores. If he remembers correctly, there are some tins of sardines and corned beef in the cupboard, along with a 3-day-old loaf of bread. But it is the thought of the half bottle of scotch that really makes his mouth water. A tumbler or two of that, and a good book always help the evening pass. A third ensures he'll get some sleep. When he first took the room, high in the attic of a once grand Georgian townhouse whose stucco is now falling off in leprous chunks, he was concerned that the other occupants might disturb him. Every other room is crammed with families and there's a new baby on the floor below. But he needn't have worried. The children are too busy fighting with one another, chasing each other around the streets or kicking a ball against the red brick walls to take any notice of him. He's helped quite a few of them with the inevitable accidents of urban life. He has access to bandages, cough linctus, pills and powders, and some evenings he has returned with the little packages he's managed to pilfer to treat a child in need. He knows it's wrong, but with the hospital so crowded, they would only be turned away. John quickens his pace as best he can, his bad leg dragging behind him, his arms crossed over his chest against the chill. He has left Holy Peter's behind now, but, remembering him, glances up at the sky. The clouds are low and oppressive. There are no thunderbolts of flame. Looks as if London is safe for another night. Up ahead, something moves in the fog. He stops. A shape he cannot make sense of jerks on the pavement. It has too many limbs, like the black goddess worshipped by some of the Hindu soldiers he used to know. A cry rises in his throat, and his muscles tense for flight. Then the shape dismantles itself into 5 parts, 4 of which unfurl and stand upright, leaving one lying prone on the ground. At first he thinks he's looking at creatures out of a horror story, wraiths or zombies feeding on a corpse. He has interrupted them, and now they are standing silently, watching him, deciding what to do. He draws the revolver from his pocket. It's as if he has sent a signal. One of them lets loose a cackle of cruel laughter, and a moment later the shapes are moving towards him. As they draw closer, he can make out the dull gleam of steel. Weapons. Why did he come down here? Why didn't he listen to Nurse Hudson? He can't call for help. There's no one to hear him. These creatures, whatever they are, can fall upon him. They can rob him of everything he has and, if they are in the mood, kill him when they decide that it was not enough. Should he turn and run? No. They will be onto him before he has taken 10 steps. He raises the gun, aiming into the fog, trying to keep his hand steady as his heart pounds. He can make out the blunt rectangle of a top hat, the smooth circle of a shaved head, a spike that might be a mohawk, the swish of a ponytail. At the same time, excited voices drift across to him. John frowns. From his military service with myriad nationalities, he's familiar with many types of language. Indo-European, Sino-Tibetan, some of the more widespread African dialects, This speech has something in common with the click languages of the Khoisan, but it's different, almost alien. There are chirrups and whistles and a sing-song humming so mesmerizing that for a moment he forgets he's in danger. Finally, the gang comes into focus a few yards away from him, their various weapons advertising themselves in the muted glow of the street lamp. They're children. The oldest, no more than 15 or 16. They're dressed in the sort of clothing you might find in a museum. The shaven-headed youth carrying a machete wears a padded jacket with slashed sleeves, like a Tudor nobleman. The child with the ponytail is in a ruffled shirt and tailcoats, and wields a crowbar. The girl in the top hat sports a ragged corset over long drawers and knee-high button boots. The shortest child, the one with the mohawk, wears a simple white trouser suit, like a convict's or the inmate of an asylum, but inked with symbols and writing. Each face is concealed by a mask made of coloured patches of fabric stitched together to resemble scars. Through the ragged eye holes of the masks, John can see their eyes glinting. They are pure white, as if entirely covered over by cataracts. The gang stops in front of him.
"I have a gun," John says, "and I won't hesitate to use it. There's no need for anyone to get hurt. Go home to wherever you've come from."
Will they listen to him? How many could he take down before the others overwhelmed him? And could he even do it? They may look like devils, but they are, after all, only children. And as long as he has possessed this gun, he has never taken a life with it. He raises it, not just to convince them that he is serious, but to convince himself. They break into their strange, bird-like conversation for a few seconds, then the lead child, the one with the machete, steps forward. John looks into the eyes of the child now standing right in front of him. He was wrong. They're not cataracts. The pupils are shining black, and he can see the tiny thread veins of the sclera behind the iris. The iris itself is completely translucent, like misted glass. The boy smiles, revealing teeth that have been filed to points. John has seen such things before, tribesmen who try to make themselves as fearsome as possible to make up for their lack of real arms and training. But in one so young, it is chilling. Child soldiers are, in his experience, the most brutal. They have no empathy for human suffering and no fear of death. The boy cuts the air with his machete, sweeping it lazily from side to side. John tenses for the attack, but instead the boy just swings the weapon onto his shoulder, bows jauntily, and walks on. The rest of his crew follows, laughing at John's expression, the last of them holding a folded pile of grey clothing topped with a pair of white trainers. John turns and watches them pass away into the smog. A moment later, there is another burst of savage laughter, followed by a shrill cry and the patter of fleeing feet. John draws a deep breath. He is not sure what he has just encountered, but he is aware that he has been fortunate to escape death. Then, a short distance ahead of him, he hears a moan. He twists round and hurries towards the spot where he first saw the gang. A man lies on his back on the paving stones. He has been stripped naked and is dripping wet as if he's been in the river. The paving stones around him are dark with water, but there's a halo of scarlet around his head, and as he moves closer, John sees the man's pale hair is clotted with blood. Gently turning the head, he inhales sharply. There's a depressed, open fracture on the right-hand side of the man's skull. It is a horrible wound, quite possibly a fatal one. And yet it is not the result of a machete attack. Looking more closely, John decides that it's a blunt force trauma. The man has been struck down or he has fallen from a height. The rest of his body is unharmed. The man has such a muscular physique that he could be some kind of fighter himself, surely strong enough to try and defend himself against the children. But there are no defensive wounds on his hands and arms. Perhaps he was attacked by someone else and the children just robbed him. In which case, could the actual attacker still be nearby? John looks around. Is that movement over by the wall, or just the swirling of the fog? He listens intently, but the slow susurration that sounds like breathing might just be the rush of blood in his ears. He checks the man's pulse. very weak. There are traces of blood beneath his nose and ear, mixing with the Thames water. He needs emergency surgery, and the hospital is barely half a mile away. It's a risk, but riskier to leave him and go to summon help. Sliding his arm beneath the man's shoulders, John attempts to lift him. He's not feeble himself, but this man must be made of pure, solid muscle. Grunting and bracing himself against the river wall, John eventually manages to heave him upright then. And wrapping one of the man's arms around his neck, he inches towards the steps that he took when he came down from the road. There are only 5, but it might as well be 500. The man is a dead weight, and as he tackles the first step, the body swings out like the boom of a sailing boat. John is reminded for a moment of the last time he carried an injured man off the field to be treated. The wound was so bad that he doubted the young soldier would make it to the hospital alive. But John had to try. After all, that was his job. And he must try now. He finally makes it to the level of the road and listens out for Holy Peter's. He could use some help, but the preacher has moved on, taking his sermons further along the river. Hoisting the injured man up on his shoulder, John begins staggering down the pavement. Back in his military days, he was fit and strong. But Afghanistan has left its mark, and after a few hundred paces, he finds he cannot go on. He just doesn't have the strength or stamina anymore. He'll have to leave the man here beside the road and go on to the hospital to summon help. But that will take half an hour. The man will surely die of shock and exposure by then, assuming that the injury itself doesn't kill him. What other choice does he have? He's about to lay him down on the pavement when, miracle of miracles, there is a faint but unmistakable wail of a siren. He holds his breath. Is it going in a different direction? But no, it's coming this way, and now he can hear the clatter of hooves. It's a reckless thing to do, but John lurches out into the road, standing with his arms spread as the black shape bears down on him. He is lucky. The horses must have scented the blood streaking his hands. They whinny and rear to a halt a safe distance away. Ambulance horses are usually inured to blood, but these two are rolling their eyes, their flanks tremble, and they snort at John and his lolling burden.
Get out of the way! A man shouts down from the driver's seat. This is an ambulance, not a bloody taxi!
John squints against the lights of the carriage lanterns. The driver wears a cap and a cloak, but John recognizes his voice. His name is Will. He works at St. Thomas's, a decent man in his 30s. The two of them have chatted from time to time, in the refectory or standing in the street.
Will, it's me, John. John the porter, can you help me? This man's been attacked.
I'm sorry, John, I can't, Will calls out, his voice gentler now. I've got another patient on board. He'll never survive if I have to wait. I really wish I could help you, mate, but I can't. I've got a little one, he's inside with his family.
John's shoulders slump. That's it for the wounded man, then. But Will is right. A sick child has to take precedence. He moves aside to allow the ambulance to pass, and Will is preparing to whip up the horses when a deep male voice comes from the interior of the carriage.
Let him come in. We'll make room.
Are you sure? Will calls back. We're nearly at the hospital. It'll take me a few minutes to load up.
It's fine. Just do it as quickly as you can.
Will, who is fair-haired and still youthful, wearing hospital uniform, white jacket and trousers, jumps down and hurries round to help John carry the injured man to the doors at the back. Inside the ambulance, John glimpses 3 figures huddled together, a man and a woman along with their small bundle, an 8-year-old child. Will was right. There is little room for another casualty.
Pass me the stretcher against the side there, please, sir,
Will says, addressing the father,
and the blanket.
The man does so, and they lower John's patient onto the canvas. Procedure that takes time, as they have to move gently, tucking the blanket around the muscular torso and thighs. The man doesn't stir.
Don't look good, John, Will says quietly. Not a friend of yours, is he?
I just found him on the path, down by the river.
Might have been kinder to leave him. Injury like that, they probably won't even treat him.
Always worth a try, John murmurs. A tremulous female voice comes from the shadows.
Ollie is not moving.
He's asleep, her husband reassures her. His breathing is steady.
Will climbs back into the ambulance and clears a narrow shelf, used for blankets and medical supplies. These go on the floor. It leaves space for another body, and together with John, he gently maneuvers the unconscious man onto the makeshift bed. John wonders if there will be room for him, but the parents of the sick child have already shifted along the bench. "Thank you," he says, and climbs up beside them. Will closes the door and makes his way back into the driver's seat. A crack of the whip, and a moment later they're on their way. As his eyes become accustomed to the low lantern light, John can make out the other three figures in the ambulance more clearly. The man is middle-aged, handsome with high cheekbones and long hair drawn back, exhausted. John gets the feeling that he has seen him somewhere before. The woman has a blanket around her. Her head is turned away. All her attention is focused on the child whose head she's cradling in her lap. And Ollie? Black curls, very pale skin. No movement, but then, perhaps a good sign, he coughs and moans softly. Stretched out on the shelf, John's own patient is perfectly still and silent. He could be alive or dead, but either way, John knows there is nothing more he can do for him until they arrive in the hospital, so he turns his attention instead to the boy. "I work at St. Thomas's," he says. "Yes, I've seen you." The man examines him more closely. "You're one of the porters." John nods. "I used to be a doctor." "Your son has sickle cell, doesn't he?" The mother is frightened, and that makes her angry.
"We shouldn't have stopped," she says. "We've wasted precious time."
"What happened?" John asks. "He passed out," the father says. "He'd been looking pale for days, but we just thought he was tired. And then this evening, he had a fit and he collapsed." Steadying himself with a strap as the carriage clatters around a corner, John moves to examine the boy. Lifting the striped pajama top that matches his father's, John lays a hand on his stomach. The flesh is cold, and even in the low light, the palpitations of the boy's heart are visible, like the flutter of a butterfly's wing. "Any headaches? How's his appetite?" "Yes, bad headaches. He's lost weight recently, and now this." "Is he..." The father can't bring himself to complete the sentence. "I really don't think it's as bad as it looks," John says. "I can understand you're concerned, and I'm sorry I delayed you, but it's only anemia. His red blood count is low. It's very common in sickle cell patients." "Are you sure?" "He's not..." "The hospital can confirm it with a blood test, but they'll give him a transfusion and you'll see what a difference it makes. He'll be fine. And I've seen him in the ward. Both of you, in fact. He's a strong boy. He's going to fight this and he's going to come through, I promise. You mustn't lose hope." As he sits back down at the end of the bench, the woman gives a loud sob and the man puts his arm around her.
"Thank you,"
he says hoarsely. A few minutes later, the ambulance pulls up to the pavement. Will comes round and tells John to wait while he deals with the boy, and he and the boy's father gently carry the stretcher towards the greenish glow of the hospital, the mother following them a few paces behind. Left alone in the back of the carriage, John turns his attention back to his own patient. Illuminated by the gas lamps of the hospital entrance, the man that he has rescued has striking looks. He's long-limbed, with very pale skin, and brown hair sweeping down in a wave over his forehead. His eyes, though unfocused, still manage to convey a sense of extraordinary intelligence. He has fine eyebrows, sculpted cheekbones, thin lips. It looks as if he has managed to take care of himself, before the attack, anyway. There are no signs of the vitamin deficiency or infection that afflicts most Londoners. He has perfect fingernails. Despite its pallor, his skin glows. If this is what he looks like when he's close to death, imagine him in the full bloom of health. Will returns with a trolley bed and helps John lift the man onto it.
"What were you doing down by the river?"
he asks. John can't explain. "I took a shortcut," he says.
"A shortcut to your own funeral?"
The work is done. John moves to the end of the trolley.
"Good luck, mate,"
Will says, and climbs back up onto the box.
"You're lucky you found me, and even luckier I didn't run you over."
He flicks his whip at the horses, not actually touching them, and the carriage trundles away off to the next emergency. John watches it go. Then, gathering his strength and forcing down his sense of weariness and helplessness, he pushes the trolley bed with its unconscious occupant up the ramp and into the chaos of the hospital. Half a mile away, Holy Peter's has almost finished for the night. He has shouted until he is hoarse. He has distributed all his printed tracts, collecting the ones that people have tossed away. At last, he can make his way home. If that's what you can call a narrow bed in the crypt of St. John's Church on the other side of Hyde Park, he will sleep there with another 20 men, given shelter and supper by the vicar who asks for nothing in return. He will have dreams of fireballs and devastation. He walks under the Wellington Arch, which provides no shelter against the cold night air, although even here there are Londoners who seek it. A mound of rags stirs as he passes, and a skeletal hand stretches out for arms. But after a day spent trying to save the world, Holy Peter's has no time for a single sufferer. The beggar calls after him in some language he doesn't understand, and which is cut off by a bout of coughing. Holy Peter's hurries on with his hand pressed to his nose and mouth. He is about to cross the next road when a landau almost runs him down, presumably transporting its wealthy occupants from one of the smarter houses on the edge of the city to the clubs and bars of the West End. Fornication and alcohol. Peter's knows exactly what they want, and he's angry that they can afford it. He bellows after them.
Weep in hell for the miseries that are coming upon you!
But his voice has failed him. They won't have heard a word. The carriage rattles away toward the lights of Piccadilly. He walks on, muttering darkly as he enters the gates of the park and starts to pick his way between the makeshift camps of the rough sleepers. He sees it first out of the corner of his eye. Far away to the east, a bright red star is moving across the night. He stands very still. There will be terrors and great signs from heaven. Does a shooting star count as a great sign? Surely if it was enough to herald the first coming of the Lord. But wait, it's getting bigger and taking shape, not a star, but a ball of flame. A comet is definitely a sign. Holy's mouth drops open as the comet burns brighter and brighter and the low rumbling turns to a roar. Is it happening? Is this the rapture? He can hear shouts of amazement, and golden faces are picked out from the darkness, illuminated by the comet's fiery tail. But now the terror of the Lord presses down upon him, because the comet is taking form, a human form, with flaming arms outstretched. Or could they be wings? All these years, he has been waiting for the rapture, confident that he is one of the saved, but now that the end of days is upon him, he is not so sure. He has been as wicked as the rest. Worse. Holy Peter's falls to his knees, closes his eyes, and prays. All around him are panicked voices and thudding footsteps. Then the voices are drowned out, and the roaring becomes ear-splitting. He is wrenched to his feet. A wild, bearded face screams silently into his, jabbing a finger at the sky. Holy looks up, and his mind blanks. The angel is bearing down on him, screaming in fury, and he can feel the heat of its terrible breath. But just as it wasn't a star, and it wasn't a comet, neither is it an angel. It's a huge passenger jet, an Airbus 519-100, with Eastern Airlines emblazoned in blue letters across its fuselage. Fire spews from its four Rolls-Royce engines, and the pluming trail of black smoke seems to be chasing the aircraft to destruction and death, which can only be moments away. It was coming in to land at Heathrow, but that's impossible now. It's tilting at an angle that no commercial aircraft should ever attempt as it veers towards the ground, passing over Hammersmith, Chiswick, Mortlake. At least two of the engines have cut out. The other two howl as if in terror. Holy Peter's feels cheated as the thing screams past overhead. Not God. Not the apocalypse. At least, not for him. The plane finally crashes into Richmond Deer Park. Not that there have been any deer there for at least 40 years. It plunges into the soft grass, smashes through trees, before finally disintegrating in a massive fireball of its own making. The glow is seen as far away as Harrow-on-the-Hill, 10 miles to the north. There are no survivors.